Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Savitsky Talks. And today I have a very old, wonderful friend, a person who I look up to and admire greatly, Rabbi Hillel Goldberg from Denver, Colorado. How are you, Rabbi Goldberg?
Fine. Good Erev Shabbos.
Good Erev Shabbos to you. And since I don't have the exact title, I know that, I mean, I know your periodical, your newspaper well. So what exactly, what's it called again, the
Intermountain Jewish News is been in the Goldberg family since 1943, and we celebrated our 100th anniversary this year. I'm the executive editor of the newspaper. My mother is the editor and publisher. My father, who died in 1972, took over the papers, I say, in 1943 and was the publisher of the newspaper during those years.
Interesting. And what now? Who's the the base population? Does it go out mostly in? Is it the Denver market? Is it all over the country? Where is it?
It's mostly in the larger Denver area, which means Boulder, Denver suburbs, and Colorado Springs. We also have we are called the Intermountain Jewish News. We have a readership in Wyoming and Utah, Santa Fe, northern New Mexico. And Montana.
Very nice.
And Wyoming. Yeah. Did I say Wyoming? Yes.
You
in Wyoming,
did.
There
you
used to be there was a synagogue in Wyoming called Beth Elk.
Beth Elk, E-O-K.
Beth Elk. There was a synagogue in Montana called B'nai Big Sky. These are our readers.
That's fantastic. I never heard of that school, B'nai Big Sky. That's good. I liked it. That sounds like a nice name. I've never been. Have you been to the synagogue, by the way?
So Judaism in the West is open. People are exploring. People are willing to do new things. People are excited about being in touch with HaKadosh Baruch Hu through nature. Everybody out here is doing something. They're skiing, they're exercising, they're swimming, they're biking, there's something.
Very nice. Yeah, no, it's a great place, and I visited Denver a few years ago, and I had the great privilege of meeting Rabbi Goldberg and in his office, and it's wonderful. I've seen the paper, and it's really good. But today we're actually going to talk about something just a little different. And those of you, by the way, who ever get the chance to meet Rabbi Goldberg will realize that he is indeed the term Renaissance person. He is a Renaissance person, that's for sure, and someone I greatly admire. So, you wrote a book on Feldheim published a book, The Unexpected Road, Story Jewish Lives from Around the World, and it's going to be reviewed in the Jewish Action, and I'm sure people are going to read the article and then want to read the book and maybe listen to the interviews so that they learn a little bit more. So, this book is written, I guess, over many, many years of relationships that you've had with very interesting people. Maybe not everyone was that well-known, some are and some are not. So let's talk about, first of all, why did you write the book? What was the purpose of the book?
Here's the purpose. I'll give you an incident, a vignette. In 1923, three major Jewish personalities visited Denver. Rav Kook, the chief rabbi of Palestine, Rav Moshe Mordechai Epstein, the Rosh Hashiva of Slobodkin and Hebron, and the last chief rabbi of Lithuania, the Kovna Rav, and they all came to Denver to raise funds for Eastern European yeshivas. There's no record of them being here other than that they were here. What did they say? Who did they meet? How did they interact? What impression did they make? There is no record. What a tragic loss. 1927, the founder of the Daf Yomi came to Denver. No record of his visit. Nothing. So I've been privileged in my life to know many great people. I want to leave a record. When great people are alive, everybody knows them. But 20, 30, 50 years, 100 years after they pass, they pass into the distant vagaries of history. So I wanted to try to record impressions to give a feel for many of the great people I've known, such as the Boston Rebbe, Levi Yitzchak Halevi Horowitz, Rabbi Nachman Bullman, two among them. Others are still living, such as Rabbi Meir Schuster, who's done more outreach work than probably any person alive may ever before. Shlomo is alive in Yerushalayim.
Yep.
And other and unknown people as well. I talk about in the introduction. I'm interested in the pasuk that you, not just the well-known Jew, on the supposition that every Jew, if you dig deep enough, has something very remarkable to say about him. So I have met people around the world, or people have gone to do things remarkably around the world. I try to capture all that.
You know what? That's really important. I remember going one time to Israel and meeting somebody who had just come back from a tour. And he took, this is a rabbi of a synagogue, he took him to meet heroes of Jerusalem. And these are regular people who are just incredible people who do fantastic things. And that's who they met. So, you know, I think what you're doing is really, really interesting. So, I mean, of course, some of the people are well-known, some are not. And Rabbi Meir Schist is a good example, who I had the good fortune of meeting on many occasions, both in Yerushalayim and then when he came to the States. Why don't you tell people a little bit about Rabbi Schuster? Because he was, and is, I mean, he needs a refuah shleima, as you say, but
I think my first vision of Meir Schuster was in the late 1972 when I saw an individual who was thin, a little bit tall, with a black hat, walking with incredible speed through the back alleys of Jerusalem. Later found out who he was, and then after the fact knew what he was doing as he was walking through those alleys. He was by nature an extremely shy person who saw the need and the opportunity to bring people back to Jewish observance and to Torah and to Jewish life. He would approach people at the Kotel with a simple question: what time is it? And somehow or another, through some magic that's absolutely inexplicable, within 2 minutes of asking somebody what time it was, he had convinced them to try out a, quote, class in Jewish philosophy. And he was taking them personally up into one of the just fledgling beginning Balei Tshuva yeshivas in those years. There was no Eish HaTorah in 1972. There was something called Shema Yisrael, out of which Eish HaTorah and Or Sameach grew. And there were others. And he would bring people to yeshivas, and they would study. And many, many of them got hooked. Reb Meir is responsible for thousands of people becoming frum, and who knows how many tens of thousands of people who've been born to these people who became frum over the years. And part of what he did was making sure these people had a place for Shabbos. And so he'd be going through the streets of Jerusalem, always on foot, to this house, to that house, whether in Mea Shorim, whether in Sanhedrin Morchevet, other neighborhoods, asking people if they could have people for Shabbos, and he was very astute in who he placed where. He had a teviat ayin, that is to say, an instinctive feel for who his hosts were and who the students were, and for matching them up.
Yeah, no, I mean, he was. I used to see him down at the Kotel. He was an incredible person. The Heritage House that he had, it was quite a person. Then you wrote about some other people that you met along the way. I know one of them is Rabbi Bulman, another person who those who knew him knew the greatness of the man, but many people did not. So, what was your relationship with Rabbi Bulman?
I met Rabbi Bulman in 19. I met him first on the telephone. Somebody had told me to call him, saying, this is a person you would need to know and like to know. I called him on the telephone from a telephone booth. This would have been in 72 or maybe 71. I've written it down. I could look up the exact year in one of the introductions to my other books. And I'm on the telephone, in a telephone booth, with a lot of noise around me. And I tell him I'm interested in the Vardik Musar. All of a sudden, there's this jet of information, insight, coming out of this man about Navardik Musar in great detail and highly informed, with tremendous phraseology, tremendous capacity for expression. I'm scrambling, do I have a napkin? Do I have something? I'm pulling out shreds of paper to take down these phrases. And I later found out through my relationship with him that you asked him about any brand of Hasidus. If you asked him about Hershey and Orthodoxy, if you asked him about the Maharal, if you asked him about the Rambam, he could give you that same jet, that instantaneous jet of information. It was an extraordinary intellect and an extraordinary neshama. And an extraordinary orator, as countless people who attended conventions over the decades learned. He went on Aliyah in 1974. We went in 1973. He moved into Senator Merchevet. We became neighbors. And I learned an enormous amount of him and watched him work. And I watched how he reached out to people, how he educated people. And I watched his incredible mind at work. So I have a chapter in Rabbi Bullman. I have a chapter on a person probably not one of your, maybe one of your listeners has heard of.
Okay, who's that?
Rav Sobel. Rav Elia Sobel was alleged in Jerusalem amongst those who knew. He was a tragic figure, very old, never married, extremely poor, probably the poorest person I ever knew, and a Talmudic genius. And he specialized in teaching Yoredei, and he taught hundreds and hundreds of people over decades. He came to Eretz Yisrael with the Sabbath of Slobodka in 1924 to Hebron. He survived the massacre in 1929 in Hebron, and went to Yerushalayim, and was, I can say without hesitation, having had a university education and having been taught by many great people, and both an undergraduate and graduate level, I can say without hesitation, Rav Sobel was the finest pedagogue I ever had. And he was a very lonely, extraordinarily lonely individual. He had absolutely no money. He walked everywhere. He didn't see a doctor once in 50 years. He had no electricity in his apartment.
Wow.
He lived on tuna fish and oranges. He had this extraordinarily withered face, very short, and an unbelievable London. People, the great Talmidei Chachamim of Yerushalayim, treasured his interpretations on Yoredei Chelek Aleph, Code of Jewish Law. I tell his story. That's, to me, the most meaningful story in the book.
Really? Now, what's his name again, Rabbi Sobel?
Sobel, S-O-B-E-L.
Sobel. Elio Sobel. Yeah, see, that's, I mean, that's a,
yeah.
See, that's so interesting, because, like, you're right. Who will ever know about that person? If you didn't record the history, the biography of this person, he would have just faded from the world. At least now people will know there was someone like that. Wow. Never had a family.
Never had a family. He had not a soul in Jerusalem. He had nobody in Jerusalem. His family was killed in the war, and he was a bacher who came in Aliyah and never married.
Wow. So where did he give all these classes?
No classes. Never classes. Private tutoring.
For which he,
in principle, would take very little money. He just wouldn't take much. That's the way it worked. If you've lived in Jerusalem for some years, you know, and get in the winters. Here's a person who never rode in a public vehicle, never took a bus, never took a car, walked everywhere, including the rainy winters of Jerusalem, and seemed to survive.
So you talk about all these kind of people. I know one of the people you talk about is the Bustin Rebbe and the relationship you had with him. So tell us a little bit about the Bustin Rebbe. I mean, people know, you know,
Rebbe
about
him, Yitzhak Horowitz Halevi, a blessed memory from Boston and then from Har Nof, was extraordinary beyond words in his human capacities and his spirituality. And in his capacity to communicate. And I am so pleased in retrospect that when he visited in Denver in 1986, I brought him to Denver for a multifaceted Shabbaton. We did medical ethics at a Catholic hospital. We did a Shabbaton. We went to Shiva Torah Chaim. A lot of things. In any case, I'm so pleased in retrospect that the day or two or three after he left, I sat down and I wrote down what he said. In his voice, I captured his voice, because part of the uniqueness of the Rebbe was the way he could explain things to people. My chapter on him is Mamash Tipa Min HaYam. It's the tiniest little portion of what he said and spoke in his lifetime, but at least I captured his voice. Mm-hmm. And to an extent, him, he's very hard to capture. It's so many qualities, and he had such a capacity for friendship. You know, you think of a Rebbe as somebody beyond and above and distant. The Rebbe was that. At the same time, he was your friend. You could be a male, you could be a female, you could be old, you could be learned, unlearned, from, not from. Didn't make any difference. Had a tremendous capacity to connect on a human level. You could be a politician. Didn't matter who you were. Didn't matter what language you spoke. And the Rebbe himself wrote a book of stories about his life, and others have written about him. Now I've written about him. Very hard to capture the Rebbe. I've tried.
Fantastic! It's really unbelievable. And so let's take one more person. Who else? Give me one more person that you write about in your book.
There's a focus in the book on Holocaust survivors. I've written about Holocaust survivors from Denver. Surely people that, unless you're from Denver, you would never hear of. Well, the name of one of them was Ephraim Englert, a most remarkable individual.
Englert, okay.
So his capacity to survive the Holocaust after the Holocaust was based on an opposite capacity that many survivors have. Many survivors couldn't and wouldn't or won't and don't talk about it, or at least didn't do so until very late in their lives. For Fred Englert, it was exactly the opposite. The way he coped was by talking about it all the time to anybody and to everybody. Virtually no conversation with him about anything concluded without some reference to the Holocaust. Another aspect of him that was unique is, you know, people will say the Holocaust is beyond words. They're correct. People will say that no matter how much you write and how many books, you know, and interviews are out there, it's not enough. They're right, too. Fred had a midpoint. He had one-liners. One-liners about the Holocaust. He would say, for example, I was in Auschwitz 3 years. I survived. I don't know how. He would say, they can kill Jews, but they can't kill Judaism. Mm-hmm. He would say, I have my cemetery and my tombstones. I carry it inside me. He would say, Holocaust revisionist? Terrific. I love the revisionists. Let them bring back my parents. I'm waiting.
Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
He had a tremendous capacity, and he was a person of great emunah and a person of great power in davening and laning. And he would get up, you know, during Yizkor, for example. It could just break down from his Yizkor.
He would
say, Eshim Chalo Shachachti. That's how he summed up everything. I didn't forget your name. He would say, it was Simchas Torah. We're all dancing in Simchas Torah. He had tremendous energy. He would say, all of a sudden, in the middle of dancing, he'd look up at you and say, can you imagine a person like me? I went to Auschwitz. You see how I'm dancing?
Really? Unbelievable. Unbelievable.
I do a lot with Holocaust survivors. I think it's
important because, every one of them is a whole story unto themselves, a whole world. But unfortunately, the time is up for this interview, Rabbi Goldberg, but I want to highly recommend that everyone look at the interview, look at the review of the book, The Unexpected Road, Storied Jewish Lives from Around the World by Rabbi Hillel Goldberg, published by Feldheim Publishing. And hopefully, you know, they're listening to the interview and they get a chance to get a little bit of a flavor for who you are. So thank you so much. I sincerely appreciate it.
Thank you for the opportunity.